What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Well, look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Adam Kempinar.
And I'm Josh Larson.
They didn't change a single lyric. They didn't change the melody. And yet their version has a completely different meaning. Their version seems to be about welcome, inviting everyone over, inclusion. I kind of liked their version better.
That's David Byrne, former frontman of Talking Heads, speaking from the stage of American Utopia, his theatrical concert that ran on Broadway last year. Director Spike Lee's film of the production comes to HBO this weekend. We've got a review.
We've also got a preview of the 2020 Chicago International Film Festival, which runs through the 25th of this month. And we've got some thoughts on Aaron Sorkin's The Trial of the Chicago Seven, Adam Sandler's Hubie Halloween.
Two auteurs. That's right.
Two auteurs there, Adam. And a film with a title I don't think we can actually say out loud on a family show.
Shithouse.
You're out of control. That and more.
Shithouse.
And on Film Spotting.
Welcome to Film Spotting with Josh and Adam. You want to give it a try, Josh? Saying shithouse is really quite liberating.
You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to say it the way my mom used to swear. Now, she rarely swore, so it was much more effective when you actually heard it. She would have gone, shithouse. Shithouse.
Really,
yeah.
Really emphasized it.
Yeah,
leaned into it.
When she's going to go for it, yeah, really leans in.
I like it. Well, that word is the acclaimed directing debut of Cooper Rafe, who also wrote and stars in the film. It's set on a college campus where Rafe himself could be found not too long ago. He was 22 when he made the movie. We will talk more about that later in the show, along with thoughts on Aaron Sorkin's The Trial of the Chicago Seven and Josh's penance, Adam Sandler's Hubie Halloween.
Whew.
We'll get some David Byrne talk in there as well, of course.
But first, thanks to a virtual cinema setup this year, the Chicago International Film Festival will be accessible to cinephiles across the globe. Adam and I have gone through the schedule, and we have some recommendations.
Yeah, and it's exciting, Josh, because we have done these previews pretty consistently over the years, and part of it is because we are excited about the festival and excited about the opportunity of seeing some of the movies that they program, but also there was an element of civic responsibility for sure. And we were always aware that outside of our Chicago audience, the segment probably didn't have a lot of relevance. And one, maybe the only silver lining of COVID is that festivals like the Chicago International Film Festival have had to completely rethink their approach. And what that means is now we're going to highlight some movies for you, not in every case, but in almost every case, you, the listener, can see these movies because it's mostly streaming.
Yeah, you almost wonder if this is one of the changes, one of the inventions coming out of COVID-19 that might stick around. Like maybe film festivals going forward won't do this across the entirety of their schedule, but might pick a few titles, arrange with the distributors of the films to make available to audiences outside of the city where they take place. I don't know. We'll have to see. But for now, I do think it's pretty cool that this is an option when it comes to the CIFF festival.
Yeah, and there's a lot of movies we are eager to see, but we have narrowed it down to five that we think are the must-sees. If you could only see five movies at the festival, Josh, these are the ones you would check out via streaming or via the drive-in, which is an opportunity for those of us in the Chicago area or its surroundings. And we should note that you can get all the information about how to buy tickets to the drive-in, to these streaming films over at ChicagoFilmFestival.com. We will also put a link in our show notes over at filmspotting.net. But like a normal festival, you can buy a pass that allows you to see multiple films, or you can do one-offs. Josh, why don't you get us started? What's your number five must-see?
I'm going to go with Apples. And I want to see, Adam, if you thought the same thing I did when you came across the description for this Greek film. A mysterious pandemic rages across the globe, causing sudden amnesia in the infected. When solitary Eris is afflicted, he finds himself enrolled in an experimental rehabilitation program. His treatment? Performing prescribed tasks, mimicking life's milestone moments, and capturing these new memories with a Polaroid camera. So I read this and thought, man, that That sounds like a Yorgos Lanthimos concept to me, you know, has Absolutely. Shades of The Lobster, shades of Dogtooth going on here. And sure enough, did a little more investigating, a little more reading about apples. And it turns out the co-writer and director, Christos Niko, was an assistant director and script supervisor on Lanthimos's Dogtooth. Of course, Dogtooth, the high concept film spotting Golden Brick winner. Also, recently discussed on the Next Picture Show alongside Kajillionaire, by the way. So that pedigree, this concept, I mean, count me in for some more high concept Greek discomfort, which is what I'm imagining we're going to get here. That's apples. There is also going to be a live stream Q&A with Niko for virtual ticket holders. That's taking place pretty quickly here, October 17. So if you're catching this episode right when it came out, and that sounds interesting, you might also still be able to catch that.
Friend of the show, Michael Phillips, had apples picked as one of his must-sees of the festival. And because I read that article, I knew, even before I heard anything about the plot, that there was a connection to Lanthimos, that he had worked with him as an assistant director. But you're right, that description really does entice me. I'm going to keep it international for my number five, and a director that we've only come recently to. We've talked about, I think, his last two movies here on the show. That director is Christian Petzold from Germany, and the film is called Undine, which is about a city historian in Berlin, played by Paula Beer. Her name is Undine, and as the plot description says it, Josh, she is confronted by the myth of the water nymph whose name she bears. And from what I've gathered, I've only read a very little bit about this movie so far, seen some reactions from critics who have watched it at other fests. It's apparently a little bit lighter than those recent films, Phoenix and Transit, most recently, a film that we both loved. I don't think it made either of our top tens of last year, but definitely an honorable mention for us. And this movie reteams Paula Beer with Franz Rogowski, the star of Transit, both really, really fine actors. And the buzz so far, again, this is based on just a few glances at Letterboxd reviews here and there, is that maybe this isn't quite up to the power of those past two films, but based on our appreciation of them and those performers in particular, it's definitely one I have my eye on, and it is streaming at the fest. So if you're curious as well, it's one you can see.
Yeah, that pairing was so crucial to Transit, Rogowski and Beer, the sort of mysterious connection that those characters had and the way they were able to kind of hold us in that mystery too. So that is definitely promising for his new film.
Yeah, and as I said, we are both relative neophytes to his work, but even from that description, it just seems so perfectly Petzold in terms of a director who makes these films that are really tied to their location. They really are all about place. And there is that aspect of mystery. There's even that aspect, I would say, of myth making or tapping into the myths surrounding some of these different locations. And everything about Transit feels like he's creating his own kind of fairy tale. Actually, it's deeply rooted in history and then also completely taken out of time. So Undine is definitely one that I'm eager to see.
All right, my next recommendation is called I'm Your Woman. And there's a combination of two intriguing talents at work here for me. First is the director, Julia Hart. She's made a couple of previous films. I've only seen Fast Color. That came out last year and was this intriguingly subdued, low-budget take on the superhero film. It starred Gugu Mbatha-Raw. Now, the star of I'm Your Woman is Rachel Brosnahan, the supremely talented center of the Amazon series, The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel. I've been waiting to see Brosnahan break out in feature films after watching her in that series. She is just so good. She's so quick and funny. Basically, that series focuses on a woman comedian in 1960s New York City, and Brosnahan just holds the whole thing in her hands. We're going to see if I'm Your Woman is maybe her moment. She stars here as a suburban 1970s housewife who has to go on the run when her husband, a thief, betrays his partners.
Is Eddie okay?
You know what Eddie is.
But he's a thief? Yes, I know what Eddie is. Is anybody looking?
Everyone's looking, and they're looking for you too. You're not to talk to anyone.
I've never been on my own.
So again, two rising talents here, hopefully maybe pulling off a big next step together. The festival is going to host an online conversation with Brosnahan in addition to the screenings of I Am Your Woman. Tickets for that are sold separately, and it's going to take place on October 21. I'm sure there will be lots of marvelous Mrs. Maisel topics coming up there, so if you're a fan of the show, you might want to check that out in addition to seeing I Am Your Woman.
Well, Josh, at film festivals, back when I used to more regularly be able to go to film festivals, back when we could all attend film festivals, I always appreciated seeing new documentaries. And I've got a couple here on my list back to back. This one at number four is the only film I'm going to mention that I have actually had a chance to see in advance. And that's Kubrick by Kubrick, directed by Gregory Munro. And I do think at this point there might be more movies about Stanley Kubrick than movies that Stanley Kubrick actually made, which I think obviously speaks to the mythic quality of the filmmaker and his work, but also the richness of his work, that there are so many different avenues into trying to really understand it and reckon with it. And the hook for this film that I do think is really revealing and makes it worth seeing is that, of course, this is a filmmaker who is notoriously reclusive. It's very rare that you ever feel like you've even heard Stanley Kubrick talk before, right? Much less do any kind of extended interviews. But he actually sat down with a film editor, Michelle Cement, over the course of a decade, and that critic assembled them into a 1982 book. And it's funny because, of course, at that point, he hadn't made Eyes Wide Shut yet, but they talk about it a little bit because he had had the book in his sights for so long and had always wanted to adapt it into a movie. So they do touch on his final film a little bit, but that really is the device, the conceit of the movie, is that we really are hearing Stanley Kubrick talk about his own work. And that's mostly all we hear. There are some talking heads here and there who fill in some blanks. There's interviews with people like Malcolm McDowell, of course, who starred in A Clockwork Orange, or other people who had, maybe we can say, run-ins on sets before with the director, who was obviously very infamous for being demanding. But what I like about this movie a lot is that while it touches on those elements, it touches on some of the lore, it really is more philosophical in framing his films. And it doesn't even go in any kind of set order. It's more about where Kubrick and those conversations lead it. And you find kind of the connective material between the films. And not surprisingly, by the end of it, you really do see that connective tissue that's holding all of these movies together. And you're still going to get some of the technical information, what it was like being directed by Stanley Kubrick, why he maybe chose to do some of the long takes and how he did them. But as I said, it really is more philosophical and thematic in nature, and it's less about how the work was done and more about the work itself, which I think is a fitting tribute to a filmmaker of the caliber of Stanley Kubrick. And that one as well is streaming at the Fest.
And if Stanley trusts you, if he trusts you, you're all right. If he doesn't, beware.
We did 105 takes on this thing, and take two was perfect.
I've never done more than, say, 15 takes before in my life.
Directing a movie, if you try to do it properly, is not always fun.
So does he come across as elusive? Does he talk kind of around the work and some of these connective themes you're talking about? Or is he pretty direct?
Kind of shockingly, Josh, he's pretty direct.
Yeah, I would not have guessed that, huh?
No, I really was honestly shocked to even hear his voice, as I alluded to. I would never be able to tell you really what Stanley Kubrick sounded like. And from these tape recordings, it wasn't at all what I thought, but it was also the tone and kind of the directness and the thoroughness with which he answered. He really wasn't elusive at all. So that was a surprise for me.
All right. Sounds good. At number three, I'm going with City So Real. This comes from Chicago's own Steve James, documentarian, great chronicler of the city. Probably Hoop Dreams is his most famous project. The Interrupters is a personal favorite of mine. This one, City So Real, is a five-part documentary series and basically a portrait of contemporary Chicago. And it's set against last year's mayoral campaign, and it also has the police killing of Laquan McDonald as a backdrop here. Now, as I mentioned before, Adam, on the show, I just moved back to the city this past summer, so didn't have a chance to vote in that election, kind of watched it, going on from afar. Now that I'm here, kind of looking to be newly engaged, and I feel like with where things are, from a new mayor to policing practices coming under scrutiny, all sorts of other issues, really kind of feel called to be more civically engaged. I can't think of a better way to educate myself about the state of things in the city right now than with a Steve James doc. I'm eager to watch with my kids, actually, and sort of help us get our bearings, see where we need to fit in. Now, I did sneak in the first episode because I was so curious, and man, it sets a big table. I almost wish it had been a 10-part already because of how much it has on its plate here. Chicago's a city of neighborhoods already in the first episode. We visit a good half dozen of them. We're in the thick of that mayoral race and the Laquan McDonald court case, which put Chicago police officer Jason Van Dyke on trial. So, really excited about this. Because of its episodic nature, there are a couple different viewing options here for City So Real with the Fest. Episodes 1 through 4, unfortunately, as I understand it, were only available October 14 to 15. They are going to make episode 5 available from October 20 to 25. There's going to be a filmmaker Q&A on October 23. That's with James and a bunch of others involved in the documentary too. So people might be able to partake in that. Otherwise, have no fear. After the festival, City So Real is going to be available on National Geographic and then on Hulu.
Love Steve James and can't wait to see this. Obviously, as you said, have to set aside some time to take in the whole series. And then we've also got coming out a companion piece, not actually, but at least for us as viewers, with Frederick Wiseman's City Hall coming out. Another, I think, 275-minute or so opus
of course
from Wiseman, right? But getting into a lot of the same subject matter, different city, but I'm sure dealing with a lot of the same issues. My number 3 Chicago Film Festival must-see movie is another documentary, and all I have to say really, Josh, is Werner Herzog. He is one of the co-directors of this film, along with Clive Oppenheimer. It's called Fireball, Visitors from Darker Worlds. Now, I read today that this is actually a companion piece to their previous collaboration together, which was 2016's Into the Inferno. I have not seen that film, but Clive Oppenheimer has the title, Josh, Volcanologist. Now beat that. I'm just saying, in terms of, you know, what do I want to be someday? Stand in front of your class and say, I'm going to be a volcanologist.
Impressive.
Who's going to top that?
Right.
Yeah. So basically, the journey of this film is going around the globe and discovering the impact of meteorites, what they have done to our planet from a physical point of view. And I love this as well in the synopsis, from a psychic point of view. And these could be really small, what they call micro meteoroids, or these really huge shooting stars. And Herzog, obviously one of those filmmakers, you think about his narrative films and their relationship, the sometimes tenuous relationship he is a filmmaker and his characters have to nature. But then you look at these documentaries like Encounters at the End of the World and Cave of Forgotten Dreams and even Grizzly Man to an extent. There's nobody I'd rather watch in terms of being a true cinematic ethnographer. And that balance he has of true reverence for nature, but balanced out or countered by his kind of fear of it, and I would even say his disdain for it at times, is what really makes him special as a filmmaker. One of the things that makes him special as a filmmaker. And this is one for me, Josh, that is not only streaming at the Fest, but there is a live stream filmmaker Q&A. It's Tuesday, October 20th at 7 p.m. And that's with Oppenheimer and Herzog himself. So really, if like me, just kind of can't get enough of listening to Werner Herzog talk, seeing this movie and participating in that virtual event is probably going to be a good time.
Well, and it's that psychic element you mentioned, that's where Herzog comes in, right?
Making
that connection between the subject and this sort of psychic impact and realm. So that sounds great. My next pick is called Bad Hair. Now, writer-director Justin Simien, he has already proven to be a keen comic observer of cultural stereotypes, cultural expectations, with his debut feature, Dear White People, that also became a TV series. Now he's back with Bad Hair. This is described as a 1980s set horror satire. I'm just going to read the SIFF synopsis here. an ambitious young woman gets a weave in order to succeed in the image-obsessed world of music television. But her flourishing career comes at a cost when she realizes that her new hairstyle might have a mind of its own. I'm basically really eager just to see how literal Simeon is going to get with that concept, because it could be pretty wild. And I'm also eager to watch this cast. When you go back to Dear White People, that was one of the first times I think I saw Tessa Thompson and Teyana Paris on screen. And both, I think, are just huge talents. Bad Hair already has gotten good notices for newcomer Elle Lorraine, who is the star. The movie also features Lena Waithe from Master of None and Vanessa Williams.
Hi. You're not tender-headed, are you? I'll be fine. Clients swear this stuff is magic. You know, in some parts of India, a woman's hair is her most prized possession.
Now, you mentioned, Adam, the drive-in options for the festival this year. This is one of those. And again, if you're listening to this the day the episode comes out, October 16, you might still be able to get tickets for the festival's drive-in screening in Pilsen. Again, go to chicagofilmfestival.com, and we'll link to that in the show notes, too. You'll find all the details there for the drive-in options for this year's fest.
So a confession for me, this one was on my radar as well, but I still haven't seen the movie Dear White People or the TV series Dear White People. A little bit of homework for me to do, Josh. My number two is also a movie that is playing at the drive-in, as well as having some virtual options. And I've mentioned my documentary picks and, of course, having some narrative choices as well. This one bridges that gap. It's One Night in Miami, directed by the great actress Regina King, her first go as a director. And it's a fictional account of a true story, which is the night in 1964 when Cassius Clay, who obviously would then go on to become Muhammad Ali, beats Sonny Liston, who was the champ. Ali becomes the heavyweight champion of the world. It happened at the Miami Convention Hall. And he celebrated the event with three of his friends. Nobody of consequence, Josh. Just Malcolm X, Sam Cooke, and Jim Brown.
When is this party going down?
Yeah, that's a good question. What's on the agenda, Malcolm?
Well, I thought this would be a wonderful chance for us to reflect on what's happened tonight. Like our young brother said, there's no denying that greater forces were at work.
You mean no one else is coming?
Well, rest assured, my brother, you're not missing anything.
So I'm hooked right there. Just getting those characters, those real people in a room together, and even if it's pure speculation, Josh, imagining what those conversations and perhaps even conflicts were like, that sounds like great dramatic material to me. And our friend Stephen Miller, who is a Film Spotting family member, I call him the good Stephen Miller, we'll just say that for short, he saw this film One Night in Miami as part of the Toronto Film Festival and had this to say on Letterboxd. The material occasionally screams this was meant for the stage, particularly in the first act, but when it settles into its groove, it's electric. Having just finished the autobiography of Malcolm X a week ago, the historical events detailed in this one couldn't have been more top of mind. Yet even with that context bearing down on it, it never once struck me as didactic or cute. The cast is just that good. And I should say, Leslie Odom Jr. from Hamilton fame plays Sam Cooke. And Stephen says that's a particularly brilliant call, as he's asked to represent a philosophy which carries more than a few shades of Aaron Burr. Regina King keeps a light touch, but knows when a tiny stylistic flourish will aid a scene. So I was already in. Stephen got me more excited. And then also looking at the cast, I mentioned Leslie Odom Jr., but Kingsley Ben-Adir plays Malcolm X, who I just saw for the first time in the TV series High Fidelity, playing Rob's ex, so her love interest that is a recurring character, and he's very good. And here he is playing Malcolm X, also on TV right now, playing in the Comey Rule, Barack Obama. So playing some major historical American figures on screen at the moment. And from looking at the trailer, I'm not familiar with Eli Gorey's work, but he plays Muhammad Ali, and man, does he do, I'll call it for now, a great Ali impression, because I can't really speak about it with any more substance, having not seen the movie yet, but it's certainly not a distraction. And in fact, seems to really get the charisma and certainly that unique Ollie tone and cadence.
Why am I so pretty?
And I'm only 22 years old. There is no way I'm supposed to be this great. Look, Alexander the Great conquered the whole world at the age of 30, and I conquered the world of boxing at 22 without sustaining so much as a scratch.
That's right. Whoa.
There he goes.
This one, as I said, playing at the drive-in, and it's going to run on Friday, October 23rd at 6:30 p.m. Again, we're going to link to more information about how to see these movies over at filmspotting.net.
Well, Leslie Odom Jr. as Sam Cooke, that's just tantalizing on its own. So
I know.
Should be interesting. All right, my number one, Nomadland. And this is a big one, not just for the Chicago Fest, but I think really the entire movie year. It's been collecting early raves, including from our own PA, Kat Sullivan. She got an early look at it and has told us it definitely lives up to its hype. Comes from writer-director Chloe Zhao, who's the writer, was a Film Spotting Golden Brick nominee back in 2018. I'm also a fan of her debut, Songs My Brothers Taught Me. I caught that one at Sundance in 2015. Here, Zhao is adapting a novel by Jessica Bruder. It's about a 60-something woman who loses everything in the Great Recession and heads across the American West in her van. Now, the actor playing the woman, Frances McDormand. So, as if you weren't already excited.
Yeah.
There you go. This is a drive-in title, too. It's going to be shown on October 24. Again, if you're a Chicago listener and that's an option for you, you might want to look into those tickets as soon as possible, because this is, I think, probably one of the higher profile titles the Fest has if you've been following other festivals throughout the year.
Yeah, this is my number one as well. And frankly, it was a no-brainer. The winner of the 2020 Venice Film Festival Golden Lion, and the responses coming out of that from a lot of our colleagues were, fair to say, Josh, at least what I saw on Twitter, unanimously rapturous.
Yeah, seemed like it.
Like, not even remotely an unkind word for this movie. And we're not surprised. As you said, this is a movie that just missed winning our 2018 Golden Brick. It was a runner-up to Minding the Gap, and I think it might have been about a half a point the way the voting actually averaged out. But I don't think this movie, probably just based on what very little I know about it, and really I had avoided even reading the plot synopsis as I was preparing for the show, so I got it for the first time from you there, Josh, but it's probably not going to follow in the same stylistic form that the writer did. That was a movie, of course, that was really fascinating in how nonfiction and fiction collided, and she probably here with Frances McDormand as her star doesn't have actors portraying versions of themselves. And we're not going to get that kind of sense of a documentary, if you will, clashing with a narrative film. But Frances McDormand is enough to get me to see this movie. And the fact that it's the next film from Chloe Zhao, I'd be in even if it wasn't for those rapturous responses. I can't remember. Maybe you do, Josh. Were we supposed to have already seen the other movie she has coming out, or was supposed to come out this year, The Eternals, the Marvel movie?
I don't remember either if that's one. I don't think that was supposed to be out already. But yeah, she's been very busy lately on kind of opposite ends of the film spectrum.
Yes.
So definitely glad we're at least getting Nomadland here pretty soon.
Yeah, I think we, of course, as film snobs, are happy for her if she took on that project. It'll be great to see a Marvel movie through her lens and whatever vision she does bring to that. But I'm also kind of selfishly excited that we're going to get another art house film from her first. At least it seems that way. So Nomadland is the one movie I'd see at this festival if I could only see one. Those are our top five Chicago Film Festival must-sees. Josh, do you have a few honorable mentions?
Yeah, there were a couple others that I wanted to highlight here. For Mad Men Only is a documentary directed by Heather Ross, and it focuses on famed Chicago improv comedian Del Close, but it looks like it's a combination of reenactments and archival clips and interviews, so maybe doing something a little bit different with the documentary form there. That sounded intriguing. And then another one I'll just throw out the title here because it mentions an actor I've already praised here on the show, Tessa Thompson. She is starring in a film called Sylvie's Love. So just a couple others to throw on your radar there.
Yeah, another international filmmaker whose work we've only kind of dipped our toes into, Hong Sang-soo. He has a new film that's playing at the festival, The Woman Who Ran. And after that, not that there aren't other narrative films that intrigue me, Josh, but it's a spate of really fascinating sounding documentaries. And again, maybe that's just me and how I'm wired, but MLK FBI is one by director Sam Pollard that's all about the surveillance campaign and harassment of Martin Luther King during the civil rights movement. The Road Up from Greg Jacobs and John Siskel, who did the documentary Louder Than a Bomb that was a big hit at the Chicago Film Festival. They've got a new one that takes place here in Chicago. The Reason I Jump is a Sundance Film Festival Audience Award winner that's playing the fest, and 40 Years a Prisoner from Tommy Oliver that's about the justice system and its longstanding history of political and racial bias. Of course, City So Real, as you mentioned, Josh, on your list, another big doc series that I can't wait to see. Again, those are our top five Chicago Film Festival must-sees. You can see our complete list if you need to refresh yourself on the titles we just rushed through over at filmspotting.net. Click on lists there at the top of the page, and we encourage you to go to chicagofilmfestival.com for all the information you would need about how to see these movies.
We've got reviews of four films ahead, plus a Halloween-themed film spotting poll, Vampires versus Zombies. Stay with us.
You may find yourself living in a shotgun shack. You may find yourself in another part of the world. You may find yourself behind the wheel of a large automobile. You may find yourself in a beautiful house with a beautiful wife. You may ask yourself, well, how did I get here?
Red mistakes from my head.
As a trained volunteer, I know what it's like when the spooky fun gets out of hand.
Officer Steve, the supermarket's selling expired bacon. Janet at the library has not been herself lately.
I heard a voice in the sewer.
I'm sorry, I didn't recognize her.
Adam Sandler, they're in Hubie Halloween, which came to Netflix last week. Hubie, a title we here on Film Spotting, at least one of us here on Film Spotting, has been looking forward to with great anticipation. Mm-hmm. That would be me, because Josh, you had to watch it as punishment for losing Film Spotting Madness 2019. A lot more info about Film Spotting Madness 2020 coming at a not so later date.
Actually, 2020 was the competition I lost, Adam. I believe you lost 2019. I mean,
okay.
A little revisionist history, right there.
So I had chosen to forget that, and also time is a flat circle. But yes, Film Spotting Madness 2021 details coming soon. Let's just focus on how you lost 2020, which I think was your third time out of four, maybe. And you did have to watch, as the loser does, the latest Adam Sandler movie. It's like clockwork. Every October or so, he's going to give us a new Netflix movie so the loser can suffer. How much did you suffer with this one, Josh?
I did suffer. Don't be fooled by the seemingly benign reception Hubie Halloween has been getting. I'm kind of astonished by this. Here's what people said, Adam, on my Facebook page when I posted that I had watched this. Aaron Neuwirth, it's a lot more tolerable than all of the other Sandler Netflix films. How about this one from Dan Carmody? Didn't hate it. Glowing reviews, Adam. And, you know,
not having it, though.
To a degree, I would say they're not incorrect. I mean, this is not the worst of his Netflix vehicles that I've had the pleasure to watch. This does not mean the movie is any good. I don't understand why. First of all, I don't understand why people are willingly subjecting themselves to this. I mean,
maybe they all lost bets, Josh.
That's got to be the explanation, because this thing it's pretty bad. The problem is Sandler doesn't even seem that inspired as he gets for these things. There's a terribly forced romance between his character and poor Julie Bowen as this divorced mom in this town. The thing runs 102 minutes, Adam. 102 minutes. Unnecessary.
Yeah, so at least 12 minutes too long for an Adam Sandler comedy, maybe 14, Josh.
Yeah. Yeah. It could have been shaved down quite a bit. Was there anything good about it? I mean, Steve Buscemi inexplicably shows up in another one of these, and he's kind of amusing. Spoiler alert: when he starts howling at the moon, I'll just say, really, the only thing that I enjoyed about it, there are two brief clips of Creature from the Black Lagoon, which you know I love, and seeing, you know, that 23 seconds of footage gave me a little bit of joy amidst all of the suffering that I otherwise had to do.
Okay. Well, a glowing review for Hubie Halloween. And I did love seeing the responses on social media to your very tepid take, because if anything, I would expect Josh the Contrarian to go against the grain by loving an Adam Sandler movie. And now the one time people are like, yeah, it's pretty okay. 51%, not fresh, but 51% on Rotten Tomatoes. And Josh, you're just ready to completely slag it.
Yeah, it's, you know, I don't know why we need to continually lower the bar, but apparently that's what we're doing for Adam Sandler. I mean, maybe, you know, I think if I was harder on it, it's because of Uncut Gems, right? It just reminds you what this guy can do. And I know you don't have to make those movies all the time. He should be allowed to make a dumb comedy, as you are intimating. I've been known to enjoy dumb comedies quite a bit. Not this one.
Hubie Halloween is currently available exclusively on Netflix, or you can know it by its alternate title, Not This One. Speaking of Halloween, let's get to our new poll question. Very straightforward, probably still a patented, deeply flawed film spotting poll question, but I'd love to see those takes on it, Josh, because I think our producer Sam has a good one. Vampire movies or zombie movies? You can only pick one. It's deathmatch rules. If you pick vampire movies, that means all those George Romero films, Shaun of the Dead, 28 Days Later, they're gone. Never existed, or at least you can have your memory of them, but you can never watch them again. Or you pick zombie movies. There's no Nosferatu. There's no What We Do in the Shadows. Every Dracula movie ever made is gone. Yes, that does mean the Twilight movies are gone too, for better or worse. And no Lost Boys. Speaking of Buscemi, mother F, I'm trying to watch the Lost Boys. I think that's his line. Isn't that his line? No, that's Tim Roth's line. It's Tim Roth's line from Reservoir Dogs. But Steve Buscemi, of course, Mr. Pink in that film. So the Lost Boys is gone. Now I know how my wife is going to vote in this poll. She's definitely picking vampire movies because she doesn't want to live in a world where she can't look at Jason Patrick and, you know, Kiefer Sutherland circa the mid-1980s. In early voting, they don't call them The Walking Dead for nothing. Zombie movies a distant second, but 40% of the vote. Nothing to be too embarrassed about. We heard from David Butler, who said, much like zombies themselves, this one is a no-brainer. Vampires are sexy and zombies are dumb, so it's vampires all the way. End of discussion. Casket closed.
Well, I disagree with David, not only because of his horrible use of puns, which you know I object to.
I do.
For me, it's zombie movies.
Yeah, me too.
And this was like instinctual. It was almost, I could have done the research. You know, I could have sat down and typed vampires into, you know, my website search engine, see what the ratings came up, compare that to zombies. And I don't know, maybe I would have rated vampire films more highly over the years, but it was obvious to me right away. Am I more excited about a new vampire movie or a new zombie movie? Which one would I want to go see? Knowing nothing else about it, it's zombies. I can't explain it to you. I know they both have metaphorical weight. It seems to me like
I was just going
to
say
maybe zombies have more metaphorical weight or possibility to them. Maybe it's the fact that, you know, vampire movies can sometimes go the romantic angle, which Twilight isn't always successful. I don't know. I'm a zombie guy.
Well, like David said, vampires are sexy. Maybe it challenges you, Josh. Maybe it makes you feel uneasy a little bit.
Yeah, I'm sure that's it.
You're not threatened by zombies at all, but I'm with you without lining up every zombie movie ever made against every vampire movie ever made, but definitely looking at those examples that Sam provided for us, it's zombie movies all the way. And not only do I appreciate the pun, mainly because it bothers you so much, but he also ended with casket closed, clearly a reference to our most recent poll question, which was asking about courtroom movies. We will get to those results here in a bit. But I know our producer, Sam, when thinking about this question, for him, it really came down to thinking about Jim Jarmusch. Maybe the only filmmaker, a listener who's smarter than us, a better historian, can maybe weigh in, Josh. But Jarmusch, the filmmaker who has made both a vampire movie, of course, Only Lovers Left Alive, and a zombie movie, The Dead Don't Die. And I feel pretty comfortable in saying that if we were just applying the Jarmusch test, then we would have to contradict what we just got done emphatically saying, and we would go with the vampire movie in this case, Only Lovers.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's a case of a romantic, I would say, vampire movie that does work for me really well. But
for
yeah,
sure.
if you take the two genres in totality, I'm still zombies. Who would have thought, Adam, it would take a zombies versus vampires poll to bring us together?
To bring us together this Halloween. It's a Halloween miracle. You can vote in that poll and leave a comment at filmspotting.net. A little bit on next week's show, our plan right now is to talk about the latest from Sofia Coppola, which, Josh, I feel like you saw a month ago at this point, but I have not seen yet. That's On the Rocks, starring Bill Murray. It comes to Apple TV Plus on October 23rd. We are also going to get to the fifth entry in our Overlooked Auteurs Marathon, 1975's Seven Beauties. That's a film that was nominated for 4 Oscars, including one for the director, Lena Wertmuller. Do encourage anyone who has been following along or not with this marathon and wants to get caught up, go to filmspotting.net/marathons, check out what's coming up, check out what we've discussed, and you can hear those reviews there as well.
Let's do a little revisiting of Massacre Theater, the part of the show where we perform a scene from a movie and you get a chance at winning a Film Spotting t-shirt. Last week, we had a very special guest edition of Massacre Theater. It was inspired by our 8 from 84 review of Amadeus and our top 5 Mozart movie moments. Our guests, professional opera singers Jamie Van Eyck and Andy Wilkowski. Now, as we discussed on last week's show, Andy and Jamie, they did fail in one important respect. The performance they gave was too good. They didn't really massacre the scene, Adam.
Yeah, the word professional and massacre theater, those words don't belong anywhere in the same sentence together, Josh.
No. Jamie was our resident Maria Callas impersonator, and she actually sang an aria beautifully. Andy acquitted himself quite well, I would say, in the speaking role. But now Andy, longtime listener, he knows the mission of Massacre Theater, so he actually did give us a different read. And this one, I think, meets the standards you and I usually strive for, Adam. So let's hear a little bit of that version.
Oh, this is my favorite aria. It's Maria Callas. It's Andrea Chenier. Umberto Giordano. This is Maddalena.
I mean, maybe we strive for, but strive is the key word, because we definitely don't do anybody's funny voice as well as Andy just did Al Pacino.
If you know from that clue, that second clue, what film Andy and Jamie massacred, email the movie's title along with your name and location to feedback@filmspotting.net. The deadline is Monday, October 26th. The winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries and announced on next week's show.
That was an inspired pairing for Massacre Theater, and we've got an inspired pairing right now going on at the Next Picture Show, our sister podcast. It's part one of their cleverly titled Parent Traps pairing. Miranda July's Kajillionaire with Yorgos Lanthimos making another appearance here on this episode. His debut film, Dogtooth, that is the 2010 Golden Brick Award winner here on Film Spotting. Tasha, Scott, Keith, and Genevieve give you new episodes of the Next Picture Show every Tuesday, wherever you get your podcasts. More info at nextpictureshow.net. Now, I don't know, Josh, that I am fully ready to immerse myself in the world of Yorgos Lanthimos at this point. There's something about it that just seems a little too heavy and heady for me, I think, during this pandemic. But really, what better pairing with Kajillionaire than Dogtooth?
Yeah, it really is. And don't forget, though, these films are tough goes, but they're also darkly funny. I did get a chance to listen to the episode, and they do spend some time talking about the black humor that is also in Dogtooth. So, yeah, I don't know if it's one you want to dial up maybe right away, but I think you could handle it.
One way that you can support us here at Film Spotting is to join our family on Patreon. One of the recent benefits of being a family member is getting the opportunity to take part in our monthly trivia spotting events. Unfortunately, we can only let in about 60 people, but these have been really successful and fun so far. Trivia Spotting, the Zoom Ultimatum, it is the third entry in our Trivia Spotting series, is actually coming up the evening this show posts. So Friday, October 16th. And we're going to have a few familiar faces join us as captains, Josh. We also have some new faces, including Keith Phipps from the Next Picture Show. And we've said it before, so I'll go ahead and repeat it. David Wayne, the writer, director, and actor, is going to be part of the Zoom Ultimatum. There's a few other names, but you know what? I'm going to leave them as a surprise for everyone who gets on Friday night.
Okay, very exciting. Yeah, so one of those folks could be your captain, or it could be me, could be Adam.
You could get stuck with us.
Which, you know, hasn't been a blessing, more of a curse so far in trivia spotting. But yeah, should be a lot of fun.
We do have a new patron goal as well. When we get to 1,000, we're going to do another virtual screening. Haven't really kicked around any titles yet, but we landed on Out of Sight, voted on by our family members, actually, that Steven Soderbergh film, and we really enjoyed it. So looking forward to doing that again if we get to 1,000. We also have a bonus episode, a new one coming up within the next couple weeks. Our family members get a bonus show every month, and they get to vote on the topic. Our trivia spotting winners have had the glory, Josh, of submitting nominees for the bonus content and then being part of the vote to land on a topic. We had 5 really good options for October, and somehow we ended with an exact tie, a deadlock between 2 topics that really couldn't be more different than each other. We could talk about Clueless, celebrating that Amy Heckerling film on its 25th anniversary, or we could talk about formative political movies, because that's what everybody wants to talk about right now heading into the election, American politics. Somehow, though, I guess they do, Josh, because they tied, so we pitted them together in a death match. 55% of the vote, formative political movies.
That's where we're going. We're
That's
calling
where we're
it.
Going.
Oh, man. Okay. I guess, yeah, you and I think both maybe would be pulling for Clueless, just for something a little lighter, but we can do this. We can, maybe it'll be helpful because we can look back, right? These are the movies that you and I saw in previous years that helped to form our understanding of politics. Is that the right way to think about it?
Yeah, so, pretty much. I mean, our listener, the aforementioned good Stephen Miller, described it this way: examples when a film changed your mind, films that were formative in your political coming of age.
Okay. Okay. Yeah, that'll be interesting.
We'll figure it out one way or another. Lastly, annual memberships now available. You get a 10% discount if you pay up front and support Film Spotting. And we got this email this week, Josh, from one of those annual family members, Andrew Haas.
I'm a new listener to the show, discovering you sometime last year during pre-COVID times. As a film buff, this show was a godsend. That's right, straight from the heavens. Listening to Adam and Josh bicker over films they disagree on or laud others that are undeniably great is a reflection on my own friend group dynamic. It feels familiar. Since entering these uncertain times, I've been able to explore the back catalog of episodes much more. The hours upon hours of entertainment was worth the annual Patreon for me. I love this show and love what you guys do, and I'm hoping next year to see you guys at the Bell House in Brooklyn. Thank you so much for providing laughs and great cinematic commentary for 15 years. Oh, and Josh, as someone born in 92, that low ranking of 90s Spielberg hurt bad, real bad. Here's to 15 more.
Well, I'm glad he's forgiven you, Josh.
Sorry, Andrew.
I don't think some listeners have.
In the words of the great Lizzo, truth hurts.
Patreon.com/filmspotting is where you can sign up to be a family member. Josh, would you like to plug your upcoming event at the Coolidge Corner Theater in Boston?
Oh, yeah. Mentioned this last time, and be good to let folks know that it is coming up. I'm basically giving what they're calling a virtual seminar. They've done a bunch of these with the Coolidge Corner Theater. Friends of the show, Matt Singer and Alyssa Wilkinson, have both hosted some already. Mine is going to be, no shock here, Adam, I'm going with a Wes Anderson film, The Royal Tenenbaums. So I'm putting something together. I'm calling The Royal Tenenbaums Family Tree. Going to talk about those fringe members of the family, like Eli Cash and Pagoda. And it's kind of a cool thing they've come up with here. Basically, if you sign up, you'll get my video lecture in advance. So something you can watch whenever you want. You can also watch The Royal Tenenbaums again on your own time. And then we're all going to get together, everyone who has signed up over Zoom on November 12th. It'll be a Q&A and a discussion. So I'm kind of just in the midst of putting the lecture together, having a ton of fun with it, exploring a movie I've seen, you know, countless times from a different specific angle. And I think the discussion will be a lot of fun too. So we'll link to the details for that if it sounds interesting in the show notes.
Do you think I can get in for free?
No.
Okay.
I'm serious. No.
Yeah, I know.
Despite all that's happened, and despite all that's still happening, there's still possibility. James Baldwin said, I still believe that we can do with this country something that has not been done before.
That's from the trailer for David Byrne's American Utopia, a theatrical concert that started as a U.S. tour before landing on Broadway for a five-month run. The version that comes to HBO this weekend is directed by Spike Lee, and it was filmed during that run. In the production, Byrne monologues a bit and, with 11 musicians, performs songs from his long career, including some from his time as the frontman for Talking Heads, some of which, Josh, were memorably performed in the great Talking Heads concert film directed by Jonathan Demme, Stop Making Sense. That maybe was a surprise to me, not knowing going in that American Utopia would cover some of that same musical ground, so to speak. My really stupid, provocative setup question for you is, if you already know and adore Stop Making Sense, why do we have to watch it in American Utopia?
Oh, this is a totally different thing. I don't know if that was your experience, but I think that's why he could return to those songs, because he's interpreting them through a different lens this time. I mean, in some way, it's the same, because I think this production explores a concern, an interest of Burns across his career with Talking Heads, but maybe even more pronounced in his solo albums. And what's fascinating is it's a concern that I think Spike Lee shares. So even if right off the top you might say, how'd these two get together and what's that going to look like and sound like? I realized pretty early on, you know, both of them have expressed in their work continual discontent with the American dream. Now, they've expressed it in different ways, right? I think you could say Lee has taken a social angle on that and a confrontational approach. And Byrne, I would describe as being more existential or ruminative. But they both have kind of been dissatisfied with the American experiment. And so it really does make sense for them to come together here. I think the timing is interesting too, Adam, because this production ran from October 2019 to February 2020. And think about what they both were doing. You know, Lee was kind of in the midst, in the aftermath of Black Klansman and Da Five Bloods. So a reinvigoration for him, I think you could say. And then Byrne's American Utopia, the album, which came out just, I think, 2018, that was his first solo album in 14 years. So he'd done some work in that time, but this was, you know, really a concentrated effort of his, a revitalization on his own part. And these two artists come together with a similar concern, but also sort of different styles, as I described. So I'm curious to hear how that worked for you, because Lee has a certainly has a heavier hand here than Demme brought to Stop Making Sense, right? And I'm curious if you felt like that worked against what Byrne was doing.
Yeah, that's really fascinating. And I'm just going to admit that I didn't really give any time, Josh, to comparing the differences in approach of Spike Lee and Jonathan Demme. You say that Lee is maybe a little bit more heavy-handed, but of course, I think about the way Stop Making Sense really deliberately constantly adds pieces to the puzzle. And I've talked about it before, how he doesn't really show the crowd for a long time because it's all about just that experience that's happening on the stage. And it's like we're on the stage with them. And of course, here with Lee, there's a communal aspect to this that he as a director really taps into. And we get a full sense of the audience as characters in this experience as well, which is something I definitely didn't feel so much with Stop Making Sense. But you said it well. It's David Byrne and these songs through a different lens, but also David Byrne as a completely different person. And I think you're going to get an existential quality, as you put it, a ruminative quality with anything David Byrne does. But there's the political aspect for sure, and I'll touch on that a little bit as well. I also saw it really through a personal lens, the personal lens of an artist and what he's dealing with on the stage. And maybe that's influenced, Josh, by the fact that I am currently listening to the audiobook Remain in Love, written by the drummer for Talking Heads, one of the co-founders of Talking Heads, married to Tina Weymouth, the great bass player from Talking Heads, Chris France. And this book, I read about it coming out maybe a couple months ago, and I've just been listening to it here and there a little bit every day. I'm not too far into it. At this point, Weymouth, France, and David Byrne are all out of RISD, the Rhode Island School of Design. They've moved to New York together. They're in the Bowery, but they haven't started a band called Talking Heads yet. They're dreaming about that, but they haven't started the band, and they definitely haven't played a gig yet. And it just so happens, I watched American Utopia last night. I get in the shower this morning. I'm listening to Chris France's book. And all I can say is thank you, Chris France, for giving me my review. Because at this moment that I'm listening, he's talking about David Byrne as a person and what it was like living with him and interacting with him and the response they got from other people who were in their orbit. And he said this about Byrne: there was something deeply moving about his determination and heartfelt efforts to perform a song. And I instantly filed that away, because if nothing else, if you took nothing else away from American Utopia, the determination and heartfelt effort comes through in every second he and his group of performers are on stage together. And that is, to me, deeply moving. I mean, it helps that I like the music, but it's deeply moving because every aspect of it is communal. It's joyful. There's no real separation between him and the musicians. There's no hierarchy save for, you know, Byrne occasionally getting the spotlight. But it's also this melting pot of performers on the stage. And there's a moment where he introduces everyone by name and where they're from. And I didn't jot them all down. Most of them seem to me, Josh, from the United States, but from all over the United States. There might have been a few who came here from other countries as well. But then the other line I heard in the shower that I had to write down as soon as I got out was, and I didn't get the exact wording, but he said something like this: David was stuck inside himself and he played music to get outside of himself. And I'd argue that's actually probably at some point in American Utopia a stated purpose, more or less, but it becomes to me the overall purpose of the whole endeavor. I think it provides some context maybe for the opening number, where he's holding a model of the brain, the human brain, and he's detailing the parts and how they all function. And then the most telling interlude for me, what really encapsulates it for me, we actually heard a little bit of it at the very top of the show that Sam played. It's the setup to Everybody's Coming to My House. And he talks about how a high school choir in Detroit did an interpretation of that song. He says, you are going to hear my version. And he points out that if you listen closely to the song as he performs it, it's never expressed verbally, but you can pretty clearly get the sense from the speaker that he's saying, everybody's coming to my house, and I kind of can't wait for them to leave. And he notes that in the version done by this high school choir, without changing a single element of the song, their version was about welcoming and inclusion and inviting everyone over. And Byrne says, I liked theirs better. And here's the line: unfortunately, I am what I am, which is the biggest laugh line of the show, but maybe also the most honest line of the show. And so this idea that he says was very profound to him, it's very profound to me too. The notion that you can take the same music, exact same music, but have it performed by different people with different perspectives, with different life experiences, and the song truly takes on a completely different meaning. Talk about getting outside yourself. That song was obviously an expression of his psyche, his feelings, his insecurities. And then he hears it reverberated back to him by someone else, and it reveals something completely new. So this is where then the personal becomes the political. I think if American Utopia suggests our country, and it does suggest it, our country must truly reckon with itself and transcend its failures and its faults, the process can't start until we, like David Byrne, reckon with ourselves as individuals and genuinely allow ourselves to connect and be willing to change and be willing to be changed by others.
And I think that's where Spike Lee's involvement comes in. But yeah, quickly, it's so funny. He described Everybody's Coming to My House, which is from the American Utopia album, that he describes that interpretation of it, because that's how I've always heard it, the way that Detroit Choir must have sung it, you know, is this expression of a future vision of hope, even though I know that's not who Byrne is. You know, most of his songs are social critique or angry, you know, rants at God. So I know that's not probably where he's coming from, but it's still that the song has always had that element to me to it. And here is where American Utopia, the film, becomes transcendent, is when it manages to capture both of those. So it's despondent in the way you expect from Byrne, but then in the performance with these people, it becomes transcendent too.
Yes,
and
it
captures both those things in the same, at the same time, in a way maybe the recorded version doesn't. So yeah, Byrne is clear about, you know, this idea of changing personally and as a nation. I think he says at one point, I think it's actually when he's introducing their performance, their cover of Janelle Monáe's Hell You Talkin' About, he says, I need to change, right? And then to your point about the community, though I would argue that Stop Making Sense, Demi emphasizes the communal aspect of that performance, that whole show too.
On stage.
Yeah, yeah.
For sure.
And
yes.
So here in this moment, Byrne fades into the background, right? He lets his bandmates take turns in the manner of Monáe's song, shouting out and demanding the audience also shout out the names of the Black victims of police and racial violence. So, and then you get this Lee cut away, right? Which is distinctly Lee, from everything going on the stage to insert shots. The camera zooms in on these large portraits of each murder victim.
Eric Garner.
Say his name.
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 Trayvon Martin.
Say his name.
Trayvon Martin.
And so, you know, this might sound, as we're describing it, like jarring, but it felt seamless to me. Those moments felt seamless to me, but it is a strong directorial hand by Lee, right? And it's also that confrontational element that he's also had in his filmmaking. So it's sort of like, you know, Lee is, in a way, even though Byrne is clearly the driving force here, Lee is pushing him further than he might have otherwise gone, or he's just challenging or motivating him as a fellow artist, maybe is a better way to put it. And I think that that's what's really, really beautiful about this whole project.
Yeah. American Utopia comes exclusively to HBO this weekend. If that's not an option for you, we shared our top five most anticipated Chicago Film Festival movies earlier in the show. American Utopia is playing as part of that fest, so might be an option for you via streaming. Again, check out chicagofilmfestival.com.
We want to underscore again that we're coming to Chicago peacefully, but whether we're given permits or not, we're coming.
We're going to Chicago to protest the Vietnam War.
There's no place to be right now, but in it.
We watched for a decade while these rebels without a job tell us how to prosecute a war. They're then going to spend their 30s in a federal facility, real time.
People say, you know, Abby, are you concerned about an overreaction from the cops?
Holy shit.
You all right?
It was until I saw that.
Are the people ready to make opening arguments?
That's from the trailer for The Trial of the Chicago Seven. This is Aaron Sorkin's account of the 1969 case against seven prominent anti-war protesters. It arrived on Netflix this weekend. Adam, this is one that you've seen, and we're going to get your thoughts on it in just a bit. But first, we want to get to the results from our recent poll question that was inspired by Sorkin's film. We asked, what is your favorite courtroom movie?
Your options were, even though this one is a jury movie, 12 Angry Men, A Few Good Men, The Verdict, My Cousin Vinny, Philadelphia, Judgment at Nuremberg, or other. Josh, how did it come out?
In last place with 3% is Judgment at Nuremberg. Philadelphia came next with 7% of the vote. 10% of the vote went to The Verdict. And wow, Other doesn't usually place this highly. 11% of the vote. Here are a couple titles that got at least two votes. Witness for the Prosecution, Anatomy of a Murder, Presumed Innocent, Rashomon, Kiarostami's Close-Up, Get, The Trial of Vivian Amsalam, The Rainmaker, The Passion of Joan of Arc, Defending Your Life, Inherit the Wind, Paths of Glory. So
we could program a fest.
That sounds like it. All right. Up at the top here in the poll, A Few Good Men came in third place with 15% of the vote. My Cousin Vinny, second place, 16% of the vote.
Love it.
But yes, it was the jury drama that took our courtroom poll, Adam. 12 Angry Men, 38% of the vote.
Johan in Lund, Sweden says, 87% of people can't handle the truth.
We heard from Kim, very racy Zuckert in Hollywood. I saw 12 Angry Men for the first time in college on a 2-inch television screen in my dorm room, and I was jumping up and down with excitement and keeping count of how many were voting for acquittal and how many for guilty. That is the real testament of a great film. How caught up you can be watching it on a very, very tiny screen. I'm gonna question the size of that screen. Was there ever a 2-inch television?
2-inch screen?
I mean, I should know. When I was like in middle school, my grandpa gave me, it was like a TV you were supposed to take camping.
Oh, yeah. And oh, yeah, we had one.
Yeah. And what do you
think? Then I don't think we ever watched Little Black and White.
Yeah. I think I saw, like, that's where I saw a lot of Hitchcock, believe it or not.
Wow.
To Kim's point, loved it. But it had to be 6 inches screen. I mean, 2-inch? Kim, you might be exaggerating.
Justin from Jersey says, My Cousin Vinny is how I learned how a courtroom functions. Over the course of 3 42-minute periods, it burned half a week of classes in my 10th grade social studies class. And before you ask, yes, I went to public school and here he nails it, but at least we were really good at football.
Here's Rob Shames, attorney here. In law school, my evidence professor had us watch My Cousin Vinny to learn the rules of evidence. Regardless, my vote goes to Other for Anatomy of a Murder, whose exclusion here makes this a classic, deeply flawed film spotting. Paul TM. More so than any of the other options, it accurately captures the nature of litigation and substantive legal issues, at least as they existed at the time, which I recognize can be problematic. A lot of the other options are an idealist version of what happens in a courtroom, A Few Good Men, Philadelphia, or a jury room, 12 Angry Men, but actually do not reflect real life. I'm not saying a movie has to do so in order to be good, but for this poll, that's an important criteria.
Okay, fair enough, counselor. Kenny Meyer says, 12 Angry Men gave me Fonda, The Verdict gave me Newman and Lumet, but sigh. A Few Good Men was the first R-rated movie I ever saw in the theater and was my first experience being able to follow a complex plot and feel the stakes of a movie for adults. So yeah, it's my ultimate. If it's on TV, I'm going to watch it till the end pick. Lots of hyphens there. I went with My Cousin Vinny, but Kenny, of course, used the magic word stakes. So his objection is sustained.
Here's Kevin Hills. I've watched A Few Good Men a couple hundred times, but still have to vote for Anatomy of a Murder. I don't want to be that guy, but you need to watch it so it's no longer a blind spot. I don't mind sending a Blu-ray. Just give me a heads up.
Kevin, we are not too proud to beg. The Film Spotting P.O. Box address is available over at filmspotting.net. Jim Pellini says, prior to Philadelphia, most movies about the AIDS crisis focused on the science of a cure and the impact on interpersonal relationships. Demme's critical and commercial hit explored the realities of societal prejudice and its impact on the victims' lives, careers, and familial support. It doesn't have a bravura courtroom finale, but the testimonies of the witnesses revealing their personal attitudes is where the film really nails its premise.
If anyone wants to send me a Blu-ray of Philadelphia, I still haven't seen that one, Adam. So
shush.
Send it my way. Here's Ofer Liebergall. I almost voted for 12 Angry Men, but my heart told me to go with Other, so that maybe more people will watch 2014's Get, The Trial of Vivian Amsalem. A painful look of a woman struggling to get a divorce in Israel, where all marriage and divorce are under the control of Orthodox religious establishments. The film shows the woman's efforts to get out of a loveless marriage in a trial before a male-only court over several years. It often plays like a modern-day Passion of Joan of Arc, but the movie also has many funny moments and a wonderful cast, including a tour de force performance by the late Ronit Elkabetz, who also wrote and directed the film with her brother Shlomi.
Finally, Kevin Kiley says, I have to go with The Verdict. It's the most realistic in its depiction of drinking, if not the law.
Okay.
Well argued, sir. Again, you can vote in our current poll, Vampire Movies versus Zombie Movies at filmspotting.net. We really need to get a few more brain eaters on our side there, Josh.
Yes, indeed. All right, let's get back to Aaron Sorkin's The Trial of the Chicago Seven. It's about the trial of the Chicago Seven, seven anti-war protesters who were charged with crossing state lines to incite riots during the 1968 Democratic National Convention. Now, the seven included political activist Abby Hoffman, played here by Sacha Baron Cohen, Black Panther Party co-founder Bobby Seale, played by Yahya Abdul-Mateen II, and activist Tom Hayden, played by Eddie Redmayne. Also in the ensemble cast, Michael Keaton, Joseph Gordon-Levitt, Mark Rylance, and Frank Langella. Adam, a lot of great names there. Aaron Sorkin also sets up high expectations, especially for you, I think. What did you make of the trial of the Chicago 7?
Well, everyone who has asked me that question, I've had the same initial answer, which is, I'm not sure. I think this is a good movie, but it is a movie I will probably watch on Netflix 17 times.
Okay.
And part of the initial response I had was the lingering bad taste of an ending that feels so falsely triumphant, even as, I'll just say, it's acknowledging something tragic. And Sorkin definitely wants us to feel that element, but it is so false for this movie to me that it is one of those cases where you're kind of enjoying the film and then there's such a clunker of an ending that you kind of start to rethink everything you saw before it. But this is a movie I did see almost 3 weeks ago. And when I need something on in the background while I'm doing something else, something I can just occasionally get distracted by and drawn into, I've been putting the trial of the Chicago 7 on. It's like music that way. And it is like music that way, Josh, because of the dialogue, of course. The rhythms, the tones, the pauses, the physical and the vocal tells, and just the different dynamics between the individuals. I'm going to say something really shocking here. Aaron Sorkin really is kind of a wizard with conversation. I don't know if you knew that.
I have heard that.
Yeah, and I admit, I am a Sorkin guy. You alluded to it. I love The West Wing. I even like Studio 60. I love The Newsroom. I was lukewarm on Steve Jobs, but I love Molly's Game, which was his first movie as a director as well. And every time I've put this film on, even if I watch for only about 10 minutes or I watch for half an hour, I do notice some new moment or line of dialogue that really resonates with me or makes me laugh. And then you do have this cast where, you know, Michael Keaton shows up, and I didn't know at the time that he was going to show up, and he gets to throw his fastball for two scenes that are just delicious. And the Rylance performance, I'll say as well, is really interesting. He plays William Kunstler, who is the attorney defending these men. And I have seen William Kunstler, the real lawyer, on screen. I feel like I must have seen, I can't believe I can't say this definitively, but I must have seen the documentary that was made about him by his daughter, Emily, that came out back in 2009, Disturbing the Universe. And I've seen him appear in other documentaries. And he's a character who, like the men he was defending, in real life, he was a real firebrand, a provocateur. He was a serious lawyer, yes, but my sense of Kunstler was he understood that this was a political trial and he embraced the theatrics a little bit himself. And more than this movie suggests, Rylance plays him with this real kind of weariness and seriousness. And there's a gentleness to him and even a little bit of a sadness that might just be Mark Rylance, Josh. Like, you might just get that anytime he plays virtually any character. But I thought that was fascinating. It just didn't mesh at all with my perception of Kunstler. Not that he's this huge public figure, but I was really kind of startled by that performance. And just real quick, I went back to my notes looking through the archive to see when I'd ever mentioned William Kunstler before. And I think the last time he came up was in discussion of Chicago 10, the 2011 film that was directed by Brett Morgan, that documentary. And I had a little snippet at the end of that review, at least in my notes, that I probably pulled from Wikipedia or something, that mentioned that Steven Spielberg planned to make this movie, The Trial of the Chicago 7, to be scripted by Aaron Sorkin. And that is true. Eventually, Spielberg dropped out. Sorkin decided, obviously, to direct it himself. And the cast at the time, remember, this is 2011, Sacha Baron Cohen was attached to play Abby Hoffman, Will Smith, possibly, as Bobby Seale, and as William Kunstler, Philip Seymour Hoffman. I, of course, would love to see that version, even though I really like the Rylance performance. The key emotional scene in this movie is the Bobby Seale moment. And I don't know, Josh, are you familiar with Chicago 10 or this story much? Did you watch, like I did back in 1987, the HBO docudrama trial of the Chicago 7?
I did not.
You didn't. So the Bobby Seale moment, and here I'll really give credit to the editor, Alan Baumgarten. It's a defendant in an American courtroom shackled and gagged. And it's not just a defendant, it's a black man in chains. And as you imagine, that carries all the weight of that pain and historical oppression. And Sorkin and Baumgarten give it the weight it deserves. We see him dragged back and beaten by some of the guards while the courtroom waits. And there's no dialogue, and it's just intercutting between the silence of the courtroom, the solemn looks on the faces of his fellow defendants and the people watching in the courtroom, and then they'll cut quickly to a tight shot of him getting beaten or his hands being bound, his mouth being gagged, and it's the sound, because you really can't see what's happening. It's the sound that's more provocative than anything. And then when he finally does come back into the courtroom, when he's dragged back into the courtroom, we hear the sound of his chains and we see the reactions, the horror on the faces of the people in the courtroom before we actually see him. Really nicely builds to that moment. That's the key emotional scene, as I said, the key visual sequence for me in the movie. But here's what makes The Trial of Chicago 7 really feel like Sorkin. And it's what I really appreciate about it, even though it's probably what his detractors find problematic or too simplistic. He takes these incredibly complex personal, political, and legal entanglements and pinpoints the humanity in it. It's a running theme through my recommendations this week, not only American Utopia, but the one we'll get to in a moment. Sorkin here finds the personal weaknesses, the affronts, and the dismissals that drive these conflicts. And if you're hearing this and thinking about the beginning of The Social Network, I am too. But Abby Hoffman and Tom Hayden, who's played by Eddie Redmayne, are at odds throughout the whole movie, and they couch it all in these serious ideological divides. But what it's really about is one guy insists on playing the fool while the other guy can't stand to be taken anything but seriously. And after we get the opening montages that set up the Chicago riots, set up who all these characters are, the first real scene we get is Joseph Gordon-Levitt, who plays Richard Schultz, the prosecutor, being told he's going to be the lead prosecutor by the new Attorney General, John Mitchell. And it's a really great scene that's arguably not essential at all to the story. We could have been introduced to Richard Schultz in a number of different ways, but I think it's a key scene for Sorkin, because for all of John Mitchell's rhetoric about these men inciting a riot and they're un-American and the threat they posed and continue to pose in his mind, what is he completely preoccupied with? It's that his predecessor, Ramsey Clark, from the previous administration, publicly embarrassed him. And so the fact that Ramsey Clark's Justice Department found these men really didn't do anything wrong and they didn't want to press any charges, we then realize the whole case in a way is really just about kind of putting Ramsey Clark on trial, as well as this version of America that they reject. But it really is all about these slights and spite. And actually, it's the same with Judge Hoffman in the courtroom, played by Frank Langella. He really can't stand the disruption of order. It's these men and their lack of politeness, their lack of courtesy, that they don't have deference to him and his authority and what the court supposedly stands for. And that feels uniquely Sorkin to me. Like, he still made it about all these big ideas, but then really reduced it down to what on one level is quite simple, but also immensely complex, these personal relationships and all of their individual shortcomings.
So it sounds like, because I have seen mixed reactions to the movie overall and some mentions of that ending, but it sounds like you would be more on the positive side overall for this.
I am.
All right.
Definitely. I mean, especially if I am going to watch it 16 or so more times, Josh.
All right. Trial of Chicago 7, currently playing exclusively on Netflix. You got one more review in you, Adam? We've got one more to go.
I mean, let's do it.
Okay. Shit House. For radio listeners, that's S-H-I-T House. Directed by 22-year-old Cooper Rafe at the time. It was a Grand Jury Prize winner for Best Narrative Feature at this year's South by Southwest Film Festival. Focuses on a homesick college freshman, played by Rafe, who ends up spending the night with his sophomore RA. Let's hear a little bit of the trailer.
So you're a sophomore, right?
Yeah.
Did you have a tough first year?
What do you mean, like, adjusting?
Can I tell you a secret? I have zero friends. Like, you could say my roommate is a friend.
Sam, we need to get up.
I didn't do nothing.
Dropped a deuce in our room.
But we hate each other and aren't friends.
So Adam just managed to fit this one in before we began recording this week. And I think it's a really impressive debut. I know you mentioned earlier that you wanted to nominate it for Golden Brick this year. And I think I can see ways where it does meet the criteria for the Golden Brick. For me, it was it's just this guileless effort that in the performance, in the filmmaking, that was so crucial because this concept, I feel like, could have gone really wrong. Basically, this character, this kid that Rafe plays, Alex, he almost seems like the way he doesn't have a place on this college campus. He's, you know, he's not into the raging parties. He's not into the horny hookups. He kind of seems like the last non-toxic white male on campus. And in a way, you could, like, a too good to be true thing. But I think, again, in his performance and in the filmmaking, Rafe is sure to portray Alex as kind of dorky too, vulnerable in ways that feel authentic. And that way the film comes across as genuinely sweet. You know, my fear is like, oh, is this going to be even palatable? But eventually it becomes genuinely sweet. And I think it's not insane to say that it has low-key Before Sunrise vibes to it, especially in that middle section where he and his RA, played by Dylan Galula, are hanging out for pretty much the entire night.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I agree with everything you said, including use of the word vulnerable. We'll get to more on that in a second. But for me, all things, as I said, go back to David Byrne, as everything in the world probably should. This is another movie that's really about trying to get outside of yourself. And you have a young man here who we see at the beginning of this film clearly craves connection, but craves meaningful connection.
Right.
Right. That's the distinction. And that's really hard to come by for anybody in this world, but especially a college student in a brand new place, far away from home, not connecting with anybody who is around him. And he really not only craves it, but the guy we meet at the beginning of the film, he really needs it because it kind of feels like he's heading for a breakdown, right? And then he finally finds it. And this is all in the trailer, so I'm truly not spoiling anything when I say this, but he finally seems to find it, similarly to the characters in Before Sunrise who make this really amazing connection, right, over one night, only to then have the authenticity of that connection be challenged, be called into question. And if you're already feeling untethered and stuck inside of yourself, what kind of damage does that then do to you? And what really surprised me about the movie is how Cooper Rafe, the writer-director, and especially the actor, expresses that damage. And I reference Before Sunrise 2. I get the connections to the talky Linklater movies. But actually, the more direct corollary for me with this film is Swingers. The Doug Liman film, of course, with Jon Favreau and the breakout film for Vince Vaughn. Like Rafe's character in this movie, Alex, Favreau's character is a fish out of water. They're both struggling in their new environment. They're both dealing with a trauma of sorts, right? Mikey is in the aftermath of a breakup he's clearly not dealing with well. Alex is really missing home and his mom and sister. And all I could think about, Josh, when Alex starts incessantly sending Instagram DMs was, oh, this is Mikey from Swingers leaving 27 messages on on the answering machine of the girl whose number he was lucky enough to get at a bar. Except this is what that scene looks like 20 plus years later. Mm-hmm. You don't call someone's phone anymore and get their answering machine. You stalk their Instagram.
Sure.
Right.
I think it was the second, you know, like I just said out loud.
Don't do it. I mean, I said that out loud, I promise you. And I think so many people watching this movie, maybe it was the second one, maybe it was the first one, maybe it was the seventh, but at some point they say, don't do it. But Rafe does it. He leans into it. And just like you do sympathize with Mikey and Swingers, but cringe at his behavior, you cringe at Alex's too. And Rafe does lean into it. I mentioned the word you mentioned, vulnerable. I'm guessing if you Google shithouse plus vulnerable or vulnerability, it probably comes up in 95% of the reviews of this movie. So this is not a novel thing to say.
Yeah. Or maybe sensitive. You know, I think that's a quality too, for sure.
But his willingness to be vulnerable, to expose himself, even playing a character on screen, to show his emotions, to be cringeworthy, to be embarrassing, to reveal a side to the camera and the audience that isn't really how most of us as men, I'll say, want to project ourselves to the world. I want to say it's brave or courageous. That seems a bit dramatic. There's certainly something fearless about it.
Yeah.
And that really did impress me and set this movie apart from maybe the movie I thought it might be or the movie it could have been.
Yeah, it's just honesty, right? He's just being honest. And he does, in the performance, he does a really interesting thing that's small but so effective. When he delivers a quip, like something that is funny in response to something that Maggie has said, a couple of times he'll wait like a few beats. And yep. What that does is basically like, okay, he's witty, but he's not quick. And it's an example.
And not confident.
And he's not confident and he's not too funny, right? So this is what I was talking about when it comes to the guilelessness is he doesn't push it so far where it's like, this is how all men should be necessarily, mm-hmm. right? It's a side we don't often see, and it has its good qualities, and it has its awkward qualities, and it has its negative qualities, which I think do come out in the last third of the film. But yeah, just that little bit of performance kind of gives you all those nuances, right?
Yeah.
And makes it distinctive.
Definitely. And I do want to re-mention Dylan Galula. I think she's very good here as well. I think she expresses her vulnerability in a different way. She obviously puts up her defenses, but she has a neediness that matches his, but does so in ways that are certainly a little bit incompatible. And I also did really like his roommate, Logan Miller, the mm-hmm. actor. I looked him up on IMDb, 45 acting credits going back to 2008. The only one I recognized, and I don't remember him from the movie, is the Kelly Reichert movie, Night Moves, I think from 2013. But that's another case where, you know, the comedy with his character in particular is a little bit heightened maybe. But the moment where they, after tremendous incidents of disconnection, finally bond, That also felt honest to me, Josh.
Yeah, I like the arc with that character, too, because he could have been a one-note joke, and he is something more. And Glula and Rafe, they've just got great chemistry, especially in that long sequence.
Do.
The discussions they have, the conversations, whether or not it turns romantic, it's just exciting because they both realize something special is happening there, right? It might mm-hmm. it might be a friendship. It might turn into something romantic. They're never going to forget this night. And that's another connection with Before Sunrise.
This is the last time I'm going to get to say it, at least for maybe a few months.
Enjoy it, Adam.
Shithouse. It opens in limited release this weekend. If you see it and agree or disagree with our takes, we'd love to hear your thoughts about that, about Chicago 7, American Utopia. Email us feedback@filmspotting.net, or you could send any comments about the show, Josh, in general, to feedback@filmspotting.net, because that is our show.
I don't really want to hear anything about Hubie Halloween, but if you must, we are on Facebook and Twitter. Adam is at Filmspotting. I'm at Larson on Film. Over at filmspotting.net, in our archives, you can find reviews, interviews, and top fives going back to 2005. You can also vote in the current Film Spotting poll on our website. Which one's it going to be? Movies about vampires or movies about zombies? There's only one correct answer. To order show t-shirts or other merch, visit filmspotting.net/shop. And you can subscribe to our weekly newsletter at filmspotting.net/newsletter.
Out in limited release this weekend, Honest Thief. Bank robber Liam Neeson wants to turn himself in so he can start living an honest life. You know how they do. But when he learns the feds are more corrupt than he is, he's forced to use his very particular set of skills to clear his name. The kid detective.
What's so funny, Adam?
I don't know. A once celebrated kid detective is now 31. That's funny. He continues to solve the same trivial mysteries between hangovers and bouts of self-pity. Did Sam write that, or is that an actual description? I want to know. It does include the words until ...
Enticing.
I'm really intrigued. Adam Brody stars in that. Martin Eden, based on the Jack London novel about a self-taught man struggling to become a writer, is out. And I do get to say it again. Yes, Shithouse, also out this weekend on digital.
I love that thrills you so much.
Brings me so much joy. Love and Monsters. Love 7 years after the monster apocalypse with Dylan O'Brien and Michael Rooker. This is now the best part of the show. Just reading plot synopses is what we should do. We should just do it for an hour.
I'm increasingly confused by these movies.
I think Sam might be making it up. I don't think these are real.
He's been known to do that.
The Trial of the Chicago 7, as I did recommend, is also out on Netflix. Next week, we plan to talk about Sofia Coppola's On the Rocks, which is coming soon to Apple TV+. And we'll get to the fifth entry in our Overlooked Auteurs Marathon, Seven Beauties.
Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Halgren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. Our production assistant is Kat Sullivan. Thanks also to Candace Griffith, Sam, the listeners of the Film Spotting Advisory Board, and special thanks to everyone at WBEZ Chicago. More information is available at WBEZ.org. For Film Spotting, I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
Film Spotting is listener supported. Join the Film Spotting family at filmspottingfamily.com and get access to ad-free episodes, monthly bonus shows, our weekly newsletter, and for the first time, all in one place, the entire Film Spotting archive going back to 2005. That's at filmspottingfamily.com.